Welcome to Late Night Poetry Jam on KKRN Community Radio. I am Pamela Spoto, poet and host.
In my heart, in my brain, on my tongue, behind my teeth. Behind my eyes, on my tongue, under my skin, in my heart. In my veins, under my skin, behind my teeth, on my tongue, on my tongue, on my tongue.
We are broadcasting from KKRN Community Radio in Round Mountain. We will host a monthly poetry show the very last Saturday of the month at 10 p.m. So here we go. And I am so excited today to welcome Dima Shahabi, a poet, writer, and editor, to our Late Night Poetry Jam. And so, hello, Dima.
Hi, Pamela. Thank you so much for having me.
And for some time, I have really wanted to have a diversity of poetry, and I've been pretty good with that, but I haven't had as much diversity as I wanted to, and I wanted to have different ethnicities represented on this show, and so that is another reason I am just delighted to have you with us today, Dima.
And thank you, Pamela.
Oh, you're so welcome. And I also want to inform our audience, our listeners, that this show is pre-recorded, and we may be talking about some events today that are happening today, but this show is going to be airing the last Saturday of December, and I think this is a great way to say goodbye to the old year and of 2015 and welcome in the new year. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to begin by reading Dima Shahabi's biography. And so that's what I'm going to do. So her poems have appeared widely in journals and anthologies such as the Kingian Review, Literary Imagination, New Letters, Kalalu, Massachusetts Review, Perihelion, Drunken Boat, Bat City Review, that's a great name, Bat City Review, Inclined to Speak, an anthology of contemporary Arab-American poetry, and the poetry of Arab women. Dima's poems have been nominated for a Pushcart Prize 5 times, and this is a very prestigious award, I want to inform our listeners. And she has served as vice president for the Radius of Arab American Writers between 2007 and 2010. Her full collection, 13 Departures from the Moon, was published by Press 53 in 2011. She is co-editor with Beau Soleil of Al Matanabi Street Starts Here, and this was published by PM Press, for which she received the Northern California Book Awards NCBR Recognition Award. And during 2009 to 2013, she worked with Marilyn Hacker on the, now, is it Ringa?
Ringa.
And that's fascinating. I'm hoping we're going to be able to talk more about that. But she collaborated with Marilyn Hacker on the Ringa sequence, Diaspora Ringa. So that is a little bit about Dima, and to think that is all is to be mistaken, because it's amazing the different writing that she's done and the different levels of writing and what she brings to the poem and to the book that she co-edited. So I think Dima is going to begin by reading a poem.
Yes, I'd like to start with a poem I wrote on the anniversary of my mother's death. It's called Migrant Earth, and it's sort of a response to Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish when he asked a famous question in his poems, actually. He asked, "So tell me what you think of when the sky is ashen." And so this is my response. I could tell you that listening is made for the ashen sky, and instead of the muezzin's voice, which lingers like weeping at dawn, I hear my own desire as I lay my lips against my mother's cheek. I kneel down beside her, recalling her pleas the day she flung open the gates of her house for children fleeing from tanks. My mother is from Gaza, but what do I know of the migrant earth as I enter a Gazan rooftop and perform ablutions in the ashen forehead of sky? As my soul journeys and wrinkles with homeland. I could tell you that I parted with my mother at the country of skin, In the dream, my lips were bruised. Her body was whole again, and we danced naked in the street. And no child understands absence past the softness of palms, as though it is praise in my father's palms as he washes my mother's body in the final ritual, as though it is God's pulse that comes across her face and disappears.
That is a lovely poem, and it's it makes me tear up.
Oh, thank you, Pam.
How long ago, is that okay, that I asked that, did your mother pass away?
It's been over 25 years.
Oh, wow. That's
still the memory of a mother like that, who was a spectacular and unforgettable woman, just stays with you all the time.
Of course, of course. And I know that I was doing a little research that I believe your mother was from Gaza and your father was from Jerusalem. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Uh-huh. They're both, my father's family, you know, hailed from Jerusalem. They came over to the U.S. in, I would say, 1948 or so. And but my mother's family stayed on in Gaza, and I still have a large rambling family there still at this time.
Mm-hmm. And then you were born, I thought we could talk a little bit about your life, and you were born in Kuwait, is that right?
Yes, that's right. I was born in Kuwait, and to, you know, in the midst of a large Palestinian expat community, who was there residing with, you know, doing very nice things in Kuwait. We had a really sort of very nice life. We went to the American School of Kuwait, but yet we were exposed to the Arab and Islamic culture there as well. So I felt it was a very nice and balanced upbringing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I believe, if I have my figures right, mm-hmm. were you about 18 then when you came to the United States?
That's right, yes. Uh-huh. I came to the U.S. when I was 18 to attend college and went to Tufts University on the East Coast, which I love and still love. And it was an interesting experience, of course, because it was a very desperate and very different place from home.
Mm-hmm. And I also noticed that your studies were rather fascinating. I mean, you studied history and international relations and journalism, and at the same time you were writing poetry. Is that the case?
When I arrived in the U.S., what happened is that I sort of turned to poetry because I found it gave me comfort.
Uh-huh,
it sort of anchored me in sort of my feeling of exile. So, and it constantly provided me with respite from that gnawing feeling of loss that you get from being so far away from home.
Right.
And it felt like it was a much more honest rendering of what I was feeling. I didn't want to artificially normalize. So poetry was that honest place where I could kind of explore my feelings of being so far from home.
Yes, and I would think, international relations, besides your experiences of being, in Kuwait, your work in international relations probably has informed you. I mean, I find that a fascinating field, that I'm thinking that you know more than most about what's happening in the world today.
Yes, unfortunately so.
Yes,
I'd like to boycott the news sometimes.
There is a downside to knowing that
there is
true.
A doubt.
Now, Dima, we have a caller on the line, and we're going to go to him for a few minutes here, and we'll come right back to you.
Of course. Okay. Thank you.
Yes. So, Dickie, are you on the line?
Oh, yes, I am. Yes, I am. Hello, Dima. This is Dickie Magadoff.
Hi, Dickie. How are you? Great to hear.
I am very proudly the person who was able to arrange for you to be on KKRN Community
yes,
Radio.
Yes, much gratitude. Thank you so much, Dickie.
Yeah, I'm actually calling in from the Palestinian Crafts Bazaar in Berkeley. Mm-hmm. Great example of material aid solidarity. In support of the Palestinian people, and we're surrounded by beautiful crafts and pottery and fabrics from Palestine. And
yes, it's a beautiful place. It's a beautiful
great setting
they
to
do
be
a
talking
such a nice
to you.
Job. Lovely to talk to you as well, and I love the Middle East Children's Alliance. They've been doing
yes, they are an amazing organization. They mm-hmm. surely are an amazing yeah. organization, and I feel particularly happy that KKRN is giving you the opportunity to present a little bit of the Palestinian side of things, the narrative, which is so hard to get out, especially in an area like ours.
Yes, absolutely. It seems super important to get the narrative out, especially at this time, and seems seemingly every decade or so, things seem to get worse over there. So,
yeah, really. Mm-hmm. And thank you, Pamela, for inviting Dima to be on your show. And
certainly.
Listening to the whole show in a couple of weeks.
Certainly, and I'm so glad that you pronounced your last name. I've been practicing it. Can you say it again?
You did a great job. Yeah, good job.
And I do want to thank you for making the connection so that we could have Dima Shahabi on the air. And I, too, I mean, we really need to have more information. I was just talking with Dima about this, you know, in international relations, that what we hear from mainstream media certainly isn't a lot of information about the Palestinians. The focus is not there. And we really need to have more information out about what is happening in different parts of the world. And so this is a good first step for the Poetry Show to do that.
Yeah, and hopefully there will be more opportunities, you know, on KKRN in the future on different shows. I know Doug has featured a Palestinian interviewee on Unspun.
Yes, he has, yes.
Hopefully we can do that sort of thing again. And I actually have to go back. I'm volunteering here, and I need to do some work.
Oh, sure. Okay. Well, Dickie,
all the best to you, Dickie. Thank you.
Have a wonderful session, and thank you so much, Dima, for coming on the air.
Thank you. My pleasure, absolutely.
All right. Bye-bye, Dickie.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so we're back focusing on our poetry. And so, Dima, I wanted to ask you in terms of where you would like to go from here, because we have the book that you co-edited that I would like to talk to you about, but you also have your wonderful book, 13 Departures from the Moon, which is your collection of poems. Where would you like to go first?
Well, maybe we can read a little bit more from 13 Departures from the Moon and then Sieg into Al-Mutanabbi Street starts here as well.
Okay, that sounds good.
That sounds good. Okay.
Yes.
What I'd like to do is read a ghazal, which is a form of poetry that predates the qasida. And usually it consists of autonomous couplets that employ a rhyme and refrain, and the message is it's fun to write ghazals because you're able to leap from the political to the satirical, and sometimes also from the, you know, satirical to the love poem, all in one poem, and it's grounded by these rhymes and refrains. And this one is called Your Night is of Lilac. Who crosses the road at night in shawls of lilac? Again, we'll lash out at the future with all our lilac. The girl wails over her father's body on a beach that hives with warships, as though she's dressed in fireballs of lilac. Layla, bitten by ferocious longing, absorbs the oiled blood of Qais's jasmine, measures the deep carved sprawl of his lilac. O lover of tabla, your beat swelling with multitudes, come rest your hands on the scripted skulls of lilac. I will return one day, she says, to light the lamp of my snuffed-out country, to translate the original protocol of lilac. The Sufis say that everyone is to blame in a time of war, while they row their nightboat towards waterfalls of lilac. Shahid, how often did you land on ashen tarmacs, landing, then flying, your feet hauled by lilac? Nothing is left for this parched earth where you are buried, says the groom to his father, except a rainfall of lilac. If you don't let my son return to his mother, says the father to the interrogator, your body will be mauled by lilac. And that's ghazal number two.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you.
Of course.
I'm going to make a station announcement right now. This is KKRN Community Radio, and I'm Pamela Spoto, poet and host. And on the air with me today is Dima Shahabi, poet and writer and editor. Back to that poem for a moment. I was just the lilac being such a wonderful, centerpiece. For that, kind of like a wheel with spokes that the lilac
keeps. I like how you put it there.
I was because I was looking at that. I was making some notes as you were reading. And I went, whoa, that's really very, very beautiful, and juxtaposed with the lamp of snuffed out. What was it? Snuffed out. Oh my goodness. That's just so I mean, that's really an interesting juxtaposition, but it very much touched me. And the notion that Sufis say that everyone is to blame in times of war. Mm-hmm. I mean, I sometimes people think that they are untouched by that, or they don't have any connection to that, when in fact we all do. We all do.
Isn't that what Jung called the collective unconscious? Where you're,
yes.
I'm not sure if that's correct, but isn't that right? Where you're feeling the heaviness of everything around, and you can't normalize, or
yes, and Doug Bennett, who's the engineer who's sitting here right now, has his own show. But I remember he was the first one to give me a little button that said, "We are all Palestinians."
Wow, how beautiful!
It is beautiful because we're all connected, and we're all to blame in that case, or to praise in that case, depending on the actions that we take. So thank you. So, do you have another one for us?
Sure, I'll read one more and then maybe we can go to the other.
Okay.
To the anthology. This is called Qasida of Breath, which literally, Qasida is the Arabic word for short lyrical poem. The call to prayer at 5 a.m. spreads my fingers over the scars of apple trees, and the smell of sleepy earth in my love's hair makes hummingbirds race into the buds of fuchsia. Not so long ago, the air grew soft when the sun crawled from rock to cloud. And I would pray to everything sacred, and I would bow and stare deeply at the earth and walk through old cemeteries to find the dead softly gazing. Sometimes you breathe red poppies over the hills in Palestine, and I see girls with orchards of almond trees in their eyes, and old men strolling silently among burned villages. And I can't say how I love my people. And I can't tell my love how to leave our land without weeping. And I can't always love this land. That's Qasida of Breath.
That's very powerful. And even saying something about it, I feel detracts from the mood that how it touched me, because my words aren't really. They don't do it justice, if I say, oh, that's beautiful, because it's very wonderful. And you have a real, when you bring in the colors and the flowers from the fuchsia to the poppies, and I really love the part about, what is it, almond trees in
the almond tree, yeah.
In the eyes, to see the almond trees in the eyes. It's all very sad, because when I think of the West Bank, and when I think of Gaza, I'm not thinking about today. I'm not thinking about flowers, and the beauty of it. I'm thinking about the outdoor prison of these people that are suffering so much, but we don't hear that much about it. And and there's obviously that beauty that has been part of it. And I certainly hope the beauty is not going to be destroyed.
That's my hope, too. And I pray, when I was a child, we would often go back to Gaza. We lived in Kuwait, but during the summer months. And that's when I was really kind of intoxicated by the orchards of Gaza, because as compared, of course, to the desert landscape, which has its own romance, nevertheless, but as compared to the desert landscape of Kuwait, Gaza seemed so lush to me, and it was full of orange trees and rows of lemon trees, rows of olive trees, and that was always that, along with my mother sort of expanding in the context of her homeland was a very positive experience for me at the time. It's very, I know it's different today, but that was my experience as a child.
And once again, I don't think, if we indeed think about Gaza, I happen to think about Gaza a lot, but I don't know, you know, what the population of the U.S. as a whole that listens to mainstream media, we're not thinking about the lemon trees and the orange trees and the olive trees of Gaza, or what was there before before the hell was bombed out of it.
Exactly.
And it's the bulldozers, you know, we are responsible, you know, in terms of the bulldozers that are used to bulldoze the beautiful orchards as what punishment for oh my goodness, it's go ahead.
Yeah, it ranges the gamut. There's I mean, it's just astounding to me the amount of replanting that happens each time there, you know, each time the orchards are obliterated. The people there are just, you know, amazingly resilient, although one does not want to romanticize that resilience, because they are injured and they are, you know, traumatized, and they're needing, you know, of course, international help from the savagery.
Yes.
But nevertheless, they do plant for the next day, and they do try.
I was reading an article some time back that talked about, and not that I want to go off on this this direction, but the children of Gaza that that have PTSD, the children of Gaza, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's a photo. It makes me teary-eyed of an olive tree and this old woman, you know, with her head wrapped up, and she's hugging the tree that has been, you know, broken.
I know.
Okay. So, did you want to read another poem from that series, or would you like to go to Al-Matanabi Street Starts Here?
Maybe we can go to Al-Matanabi Street Starts Here and then return to end up with the poem later on in the program, if that's okay with you.
Oh, that's perfectly fine with me. Is it okay if I read? And I'm not exactly sure what to call them. They're like testimonials. They're praises.
The blurbs on the back.
Yeah,
of the
yes,
book.
For yes, the book. Uh-huh. Is it okay if I read two of those before?
Of course, please.
And the first one is shorter, and it's written by an associate professor of English from Virginia Tech University. I think his name is Stephen Salaita.
Salaita.
Okay. And this is what he says. He said, "The collection of materials in this anthology is astounding and harrowing. Boussalet, if I said that right, and Shahabi have put together a book that will be adored by lovers of poetry, essays, journalism, and testimony. It will also be required reading for anyone interested in social justice." And social justice, I mean, that is to me one of the most important principles that that we can live by. And at the same time, you know, that first sentence, astounding and harrowing, it's kind of like the beauty of the trees and the scents of the flowers, and we know the joyousness there, and at the same time the bulldozers and the bombs and the suffering. I mean, it's both. It's so much both at the same time. And then the other blurb that I'd like to read is from the chair of Classical Middle Eastern and Asian Languages and Cultures at Queen's College. And I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. Is it Amiel?
Amiel. Alkaleh, you got it.
Okay. So it's a little bit longer, but it's very profound, I think. So he says, "Propaganda reigns when there are no natural alliances of self-defense, when image makers, the poets, novelists, journalists, filmmakers, photographers, and artists have no personal relationships with their counterparts across zones of conflict. Al-Matanabi Street Starts Here steps directly into this vacuum, holding the mirror of resistance directly in our acquiescent eyes, reminding us that before the invasion of Iraq, there were sanctions. That before the sanctions, there was Saddam Hussein, part of an elaborate web of U.S.-supported and inspired totalitarianism that has kept the peoples of the Middle East in a stranglehold for a good part of the 20th century. This extraordinary collection asks us to account for our lack of resistance and to begin learning just what it might mean to resist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that is part of what we mentioned at the very beginning today, that we are all connected. We are all part of this web of life. And to think what happens, you know, in the Middle East, all these countries that are suffering right now, and often as a result of U.S.-led
war
and droning and bombs, that we have to take responsibility and we have to step up. So that I won't say any more about that. So maybe you could share what you would like to share about the book or how.
Sure.
Yes.
I mean, sure. Just to kind of talk a little bit more about what you were saying about what this anthology and the project of Al-Mutanabbi Street seeks to do as a whole, is to sort of cement solidarity between the Iraqi community of writers and artists and their counterparts here in America. In addition to that, Bobo Saleh's vision was that we would sort of make this anthology into a spatial metaphor, so whereby, you know, we're trying to clear the space for some of the debris that's coming out of Iraq. And many people are not aware that 1 million Iraqis have died in the war. The figures, I mean, are just astoundingly harrowing, as Stephen said, beyond harrowing. In addition to that, you know, it's the war that led to other wars. And
Yes.
And so, and I mean, again, also just kind of digging into what you were saying earlier about what is it that, how do we end wars and how do we not absolve ourselves? I think it's just about, you know, war and money and
yes.
the idea. Wasn't it General Smedley D. Butler who talked about if you take the profit out of war, then there will be no war. But until that time, I think that, you know, the military-industrial complex reigns supreme.
Yes, unfortunately.
Unfortunately. So this is kind of, again, this anthology seeks to sort of clear the space for some of the debris that came out of Al-Mutanabbi Street and out of Iraq as a whole, Al-Mutanabbi Street being sort of a small symbol or a microcosm of the larger tragedy. And so, of course, what happened on March 5th, 2007, is a car bomb exploded on Al-Mutanabbi Street in Baghdad. And Al-Mutanabbi Street is the historic literary district. It's a block that's just full of cafes and bookstores and publishing houses. And one of the coffee houses called El Shabandar Cafe was a meeting place for generations of Iraqi writers and intellectuals. That cafe was blown to pieces. And not only did the owner lose his sons, but he lost his sons, he lost his livelihood, and, you know, a lot of hope as well. At that time, on March 5th, 2007, 30 people died and 100 were wounded in the blast, and no one ever really claimed responsibility. And again, I mean, it makes you think of when there is a time of war, you know, if you want to destroy a culture or society, you destroy its writers and its poets and its image makers, because those are the holders or the people who hold all the memories.
Yes.
And so, as a result, you have San Francisco bookseller Bobo Saleh, who is a poet and proprietor of the great Overland Book Company as well, and he sort of waited. He thought, okay, well, people are going to kind of see this as an attack on us, not just on all booksellers, on all publishers, on all people who love word. And he waited for this to happen, and nothing actually happened. And so he felt compelled to do something after the attack. And so that's when he began an art and writing project called Al-Mutanabbi Street Starts Here, mm-hmm. which it's to express solidarity as well as respond to the attack. And it's grown beautifully into this, you know, it has two components. One is the anthology and one is the beautiful broadsides, which, have you seen them at all, Pamela?
I haven't. I saw a copy of the cover of the book, but I didn't see the, no.
Mm-hmm. They're really astounding. There's a few, you know, they've been to the Arab American National Museum, they've been to England, they're beautiful, and the words just kind of seem to step out of the page and encompass the person. They're amazing. So again, that's I'd like to read. So this is what the idea of the anthology is. It's, you know, it's about this vision that Bo had. But there's I'd like to read a little excerpt from Lutfia Al-Dulaimi, who's a woman who is a fiction writer who's written over 20 books in Iraq and has been translated. She now lives in Amman, Jordan. But she writes about what Al-Mutanabbi means to her, and this is from the anthology. Before I was born on Al-Mutanabbi Street, I was no one. I could deny the documents that made reference to my birth on a particular day of the year on a certain province of the country. I was a mere small woman without a place in this world. Then I was born on Al-Mutanabbi Street the day my first book was published, a passage, The Sadness of Men. I had discovered as a girl of nine the richness of the story through 1001 nights in a room that girls were forbidden to enter, and I was determined to become the contemporary Shahrazad. The young girl had no future except perhaps to become a woman set aside to live a pointless life among quiet, forgotten women. But Shahrazad, the first woman to use the magic of imagination to narrate the tales of the East, plucked me out of my time and visited upon me the spell of dreams and tattooed a shining mark on my forehead, setting in my place my destiny as had the gods and goddesses of old. Go to the place of books. You will be one of those women who narrate stories, one of the daughters of Shahrazad. And she continues to say, no writer or poet from Baghdad or any other city in Iraq lacks a piece of memory from that venerable street of books and bookshops, the modern bookshop, the Nahda bookstore, Al-Ma'rifa bookstores, Al-Muthanni and others. Who among us had not been enticed by the magical stacks of books on the pavements and carts, or walked awestruck browsing titles and sniffing the scents of the pages? Who among us could forget the pleasure of buying new books in the 1970s or banned and Xerox books in the 90s during that period of sanctions? Fridays were like holidays to commemorate the gathering of friends and the purchase of new books on Al-Mutanabbi Street. That street was a paradise for readers and writers, an enchanted gateway for the passers-by to approach the treasures of a culture. It was a market for wordsmiths and stationers, a place for the most extreme celebrations of the mind. It had a place of luminous distinction in the memories and dreams of its visitors. It encompassed the calamitous losses bequeathed by a history of defeats, rulers and brutality. It was the domain of poets, writers, traders in manuscripts and booksellers, seekers of fame, and yes, spies listening intently to the whispers of intellectuals. In the 90s, it was even subject to raids by security forces. Banned books that had been copied and produced were published there, and those driven mad by the cruelty of war would wander up and down, reciting classical poetry that made fun of the dictator, or yelling out mock news broadcasts that tore through the silence of the writers who stood by, petrified at how the brutal regime might respond. So this is from her little essay.
Yes. It's, and as you mentioned initially, it is a microcosm. It is symbolic of so much more, you know. And I was thinking about this last night. Here is, I'm thinking one little street. Maybe it was bigger than one little street. I mean, not a little street, but the idea that so many streets in Baghdad and Iraq have been just decimated. But that this was a street of words, of people speaking out, of you know, of books and essays and poets and creativity and freedom, and then just bombed, gone, dead.
Exactly.
And
indeed, yes, go ahead. Sorry, Pamela.
No, I'm sorry. I was just told I should announce the show, and I'm going to do that. So
Sure. Go right ahead.
This is KKRN Community Radio, 88.5 on your radio dial out of Round Mountain. I'm Pamela Spoto, poet and host of Late Night Poetry Jams and Jam, and we're here talking with Dima Shahabi. And this is wonderful, and we're getting educated a bit more, or a lot more, on international situations, specifically in the Middle East, and even more specifically to this one street street in Baghdad that was bombed. That was the street of poets. And that's just amazing. And you know, Dima, what you said earlier as you were prefacing your comments here, that I don't think people, most people realize that over a million Iraqis have been killed. And that whole notion of sanctions, you know, not notion, but the whole sanction period before that time, and so many hundreds of thousands of children dead.
Exactly.
And we get upset if, a person or two dies here or there, and rightly so. Human beings are human beings. But the magnitude of death in the Middle East is beyond description.
It really is. It really feels it's apocalyptic.
And, yes.
I was recently speaking with a coworker, and we were talking about, how America is going to lead how it will continue to lead In order for America to continue to lead, how is it going to understand these narratives that are coming out of these regions? And build upon them, because there's such a disconnect between that apocalypse that the Middle East is going through and people here. It's a massive disconnect, and I think, I mean, it's purposeful. I think it's since the Vietnam War. Isn't it true that now there are more embedded journalists that sort of just parrot what the U.S. military wants? And,
well. Embedded to me means in bed with, so yes,
yeah.
that is true. And how convenient that is, you have embedded journalists, because they're giving you they're told to give you, or what they're allowed to give you. And corporate media, obviously, mainstream media is controlled by corporations, and so that is the information we get. And so a lot of Americans are absolutely in the dark about what is happening, why it's happening, our role in it, the whole notion of the military-industrial complex, and all the money that it's made. And it makes, I mean, killing is good for business. And that is, to me, is sickness.
Is really
a sickness. And to me, the principles that we should be espousing would be compassion and connection and taking care of each other and being part of this global community. But it doesn't seem like that is the direction And so maybe that brings me to the point of wanting to ask you here the role of the poet, because here you have a street in Baghdad that was full of people being creative, speaking out, you know, sharing what was on their hearts, and then they're bombed to hell. The role of the poet today, I mean, how do you see yourself in that? What would you say to me as a poet, you know, in terms of our connection or our speaking out, or what do you think?
I think that we encompass the sensibilities that are not the sound bites and the snappy, you know, conclusions that we're given all the time. So our responsibility, I think, as poets, is really to provide a counter narrative to what's accepted and what's acceptable. It's almost to subvert, actually, what is out there in the media. And so, I mean, I think that was the job for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
That was the job of poets, is to subvert the mainstream
mm-hmm.
narrative. No longer. What you're finding is that the people that are coming out of, you know, the MFA and coming out of
yes.
universities and things like that, I don't know if they're really engaging in those kinds of, maybe you can correct me, and I don't mean to judge harshly at all. But it does seem like there's so many wonderful American political poets, namely, you know, Adrian Rich, Marilyn
yes.
Hack. We run the gamut of that. But I'm talking about young people. I'm talking
yes.
about they're grappling with, you know, what they're given in the media. As and again, they're getting, you know, they're on Instagram. They're getting the sound bites. They're getting the news. And so how do you make them critical thinkers and purveyors of a different narrative is quite a challenge at this stage.
You know, it is an interesting challenge. And my small group of friends, I mean, and poets and writers and bloggers and so forth, we talk about this a lot because, you know, how do we get the word out is number one. and number two, I think that social justice is a component, is in my writing, that's definitely true. Social justice is a major component. And I was thinking about African Americans within our country, and there was, and I think you're absolutely spot on. You're absolutely right. I mean, there was a debate about what is the role of writing. You know, what is the Black experience, and so you had writers arguing that yes, it's about the struggle, it's about social justice, and then others saying, well, you know, it's aesthetic, it's not that I can define what the role should be, but I know for me and what in terms of what's going on in the world today, social justice has to be in my opinion,
exactly
has to be a part of it. I mean, how else is if any kind of positive change is going to happen, how else is it going to happen without a change of consciousness? And how does that happen? You know, so
exactly. And then how to cleanse the language of its sort of biases?
Yes,
is a big is I think a really big problem that, you know, maybe just like a high school course in propaganda. I don't know. It's quite a challenge.
Well, I was talking, and maybe I shouldn't even talk about this, but I was talking to a friend of mine just the other day that, you know, and I do teach it. Ironically, a critical thinking class, and I was listening to the news and saying, you know, we have to be really aware of radicalization, and sometimes critical thinking is seen as radicalization that is going against what the mainstream idea and ideology is, and that's just not right. It's kind of scary in a way, you know.
Almost Orwellian in its
yes
message. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. That double speak. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So would you like to read more poetry? Would you like to talk about your writing life? Well, maybe you could tell the audience, if the audience, and I think they should be, interested in getting your books, how they might do that.
Oh, sure. There are, you know, of course, the books are available on, online, then of course directly from the publisher Press 53, and from PM Press, which is the publisher of Anishinaabe Street Starts Here, and so online and directly with the publishers as well.
And so, for example, I could go on Amazon and plug in your name, and I could order 13 Departures from the Moon.
Yes, that's correct.
Good. Excellent. Absolutely. Excellent. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your writing life? I mean, I'm always fascinated if a person, a poet, a writer, writes every day or so many hours a day or how one sets aside time to do that and getting distracted by the dishes or food or something else, or
it's definitely a struggle, and I'm with you on this completely. I had a teacher once tell me that you have to make a date to sit and write
yes.
to write poetry. Like it's your job to do that, and you must do that because when you sit and do it every day, it will come. And that's I found to be true. However, I recently haven't been as disciplined as I would like. And, you know, there's just life is very distracting. And, again, maybe we should boycott the news. And I'm really being sarcastic here. I don't know. I think that poetry, it comes sort of that feeling that you get when the language, just something in your heart needs to say what it needs to say. And the expression in your language seems like you're trying to bridge some kind of sensibility. And for me especially, I mean, many of the earlier struggles I had to do with finding a bridge, finding a voice that bridged two sensibilities, namely where I came from and where I am now. And so that always sort of seemed, my perception of what constituted expression and language seemed sort of diametrically opposed to the dominant modes of thinking. We talked about social justice, for example, right, Pamela, and how... Mm-hmm. when you write a lot about social justice, the current sort of mode of thinking is that it needs to be done well, or it's considered tendentious poetry, or poetry that has a poetry that has an agenda, which is, you know, in the canon, that's like the worst thing to have. Like, if a critic says your poetry is so political that it has an agenda, that's sort of considered a very bad, not a compliment, indeed. And you know, so I think Tony Hoagland said that most Americans have a view, they have a distrust of language and a distrust of information. And I wonder if America's lack of, you know, we are a small, us lovers of poetry, we are a small but intense group. But how to make it larger, I think, has to do with the nature of trust. And so one mode of thinking at the time when I was struggling with writing my first book was that good poetry had to be purged of its historical and political references. But another mode of thinking was that the language had to be restrained and completely cleansed of sort of ornamental representation, which is exactly the opposite of how I write. Because my relationship with language had everything to do with lush evocation of place.
Yes.
And so so those are kind of some of the struggles that I went through as a younger poet. I guess, does that answer your question? Or
yes, and I was thinking about, and I know exactly what you're saying about especially political poetry, because I tend to do that once in a while, or if it has an agenda, or it's this or it's that, and mm-hmm. and you know, I think that really does trouble me, because yes, by golly, I have an agenda, so if I'm criticized for that, but the military industrial complex that spends $1 trillion a year on the killing machine, but that's mm-hmm. okay, but
it's quite ironic.
It's very ironic, and so maybe. Life has these so many contradictions, and I guess contradictions, but it is the irony of it is pretty amazing. So if I understood the very last part of what you're saying is mm-hmm. that cleansing this poetry were you saying that is you are not cleansing your poetry?
That's right. No, I'm not cleansing of it, a historical and political reference. It's, you know, full of those. However, what is all I said was that I felt the pressures of that as a young writer, of that kind of tendency in American poetry to want those cleansed.
Yes.
And of course, and people have rebelled against that, you know, throughout the centuries.
But there is this
pressure. How do you enter the canon saying what you need? Or, you know, or not.
And, yes.
So those are the kinds of things that I was thinking about and writing about when I was kid.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's true in terms of, and it's probably not true of all MFA programs, but a sense that I do get from some MFA programs, and I'm on the outside of that, is that, so I may be a little too critical, is that people can come out sounding alike. With a certain tone, with a certain movement, with a certain just alike, and that's not what I want to do. You know, that's not, to me, that's not that creative expression that I want to, you know, pursue. So that's
absolutely
that's interesting. So I think we have about, I don't know, 10 minutes or so left, and I'm wondering if and maybe I should make another radio announcement here. I'm sorry. Or not.
No problem.
This is KKRN Community Radio. I'm Pamela Spoda with Late Night Poetry Jams, and I'm sharing this time with Dima Shahiba, a wonderful poet and editor and writer, and very thought-provoking comments. So, would you like to read us a few more poems, or would you like to talk about your collaboration with Marilyn Hacker? That was an interesting form. I mean, is mm-hmm. can I just ask you about Ringa for a moment?
Yes, of course.
would you prefer to? We don't have a lot of time left. Would you prefer to go in another direction right now?
No, sure, that sounds great, Pamela, that would be great. I'll be happy to talk about the Ringa. The Ringa is, what was wonderful about it was that both Marilyn and I had never, you know, met, but she sent me her first Ringa during the first war on Gaza by Israel, And I don't know if she meant that I respond, but I sort of took it as an invitation, and perhaps it was a need for me to respond in my own Renga. And so basically a Renga is just means linked poem,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, is an ancient Japanese form, and it's encouraging. It encourages the collaborative composition of poetry. And it consists of the alternate three-line and two-line stanzas.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, and, you know, it's basically to create a Renga, one poet writes the first stanza, the next one mm-hmm. responds to it, et cetera, until it became a book. We did not expect that. It just kept going.
I see, yes.
Which was wonderful, because what I loved about writing with Marilyn and is for you as a poet to have such a lovely reader right away that responds to your work was just amazing and beautiful. And so it took me out of the solitary nature of writing into more community writing.
Mm-hmm.
But that was
mm-hmm.
unique. That was very unique.
Did you, and I know that there are, as in haiku, different variations on it, but did you count syllables, or did you need to do that, or was it more open than that? Or
so Marilyn wrote, yes, Marilyn did count her syllables. She's
definitely a formalist. Well, good
She's
for her.
She's definitely a formalist. Yes, exactly. I did not. I was more loose with it.
I see. I see. And I printed something off, but it's probably not complete, and it may not even start at the beginning. But for example, it just kind of goes back and forth. It says, you know, Marilyn and Dima, but I just mm-hmm. these first very few lines, and Marilyn says, her father will die without seeing her again. He's 94 now.
Mm-hmm.
And then you respond, you know, with this smells like talc, and it's really, mm-hmm. it's really lovely. So would you like to read from that, or would you like to go back to 13 departures from the moon?
Sure, I'd love to read from that, from the Diasporinga.
Okay.
I'll just read, I won't say Marilyn Dima, I'll just read
okay.
directly through, because it's, okay. Marilyn starts off by saying, 5'6" and righteous, the child in green in Gaza stands in her wrecked home. Grubby, indignant, her hands point. She explained what was done. Bombed, burned. It all smells like gas. We had to throw our clothes away. The earrings my father gave me. No martyr, resistance. The burnt cradle. Breaks over the cold mountains of North Carolina, where a Cherokee poet huddles in a cottage by an indigo fire. She sees the child and says, this is the new trail of tears.
Mm.
Calls out, oh, outspread Indian nation, let's braid our hair with the pulverized gravel of Palestine.
Mm.
Witness, she says, the unpinned knuckles of this child. Feel the burlap curtains whip across. And then it goes on back and forth like that throughout. For
My. Especially the part of, you know, this is the new trail of tears. I mean, the total suffering of the people, and and the child standing in the bomb burned, smelling like gas. And see, that is the thing. When people in the U.S. think about bombs, they're not getting into what the bomb does. I mean,
exactly. It's been cleansed. It's really been,
yes,
you know,
exactly.
The horror of war has been cleansed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That, oh yeah, we'll just drop a bomb and that'll take care of that. Yeah, that's a solution. And I'm thinking, well, now wait a minute. The skin is melting and dripping off this child or this grandmother or this father. I mean, oh my God. And that is, and in the Renga that you just, partial one that you just read, I mean, mm-hmm. it's just, oh my goodness. So I'm stuttering. I'm so excited about this, so when you and Marilyn Hacker were writing this, you would write something and then she would get it and then she would respond or take from that stanza.
She'll take a word or yeah. some kind. She'll mm-hmm. take a word and sort of weave it back into the to her response
mm-hmm.
and link mm-hmm. it like that, and on and on. And it went on for approximately 3.5 years.
Oh my goodness! Really?
Mm-hmm. By email, because she was in, again, she resides in Paris and I'm in Northern California.
Uh-huh.
And but what a gift. And yes. I it was a real gift to do this with her.
We have maybe 3 minutes left. Is there is there something that you would like to say, or was there a poem that you would like to finish with?
Sure.
This has been very, very wonderful for
it's
us.
It's wonderful to really have a conversation with you, Pamela. Wonderful to be here, really. It's, and giving all, a whole hour for poetry is just incredible and amazing.
Yes, it's great, isn't it?
I love that, yes. I'd like to end on a poem, with a poem, rather. And it's called Curves in the Dark, and it's a conversation with my husband on the meaning of roots and what it means to establish roots somewhere.
Mm.
Curves in the Dark. There will be no creeks left in the hills below Diablo Mountain, no blowsy almond orchards or rust-purple grass before green. No one will come to us and ask, do you recall the struggle of moon-vein blossoms and the carnage of deer in the thinned-out valley? No gray-haired woman will be left to tell a flood of warm-eyed children weave those acorns back through the leaves so they can be found by animals starved by winter. And you thought the Iraqi moon high above palms would fall over our fragments, and this live oak you placed in California earth would give us refuge against shadowed rustling. But this moon is neighbor to everyone, barefooted blade of silver searching for a flawed heart to swell. I touch the chill in my forehead and wonder what it would be like to lose all my hair. Jasmine, with your knife of scent, I hope my child never has to kneel over my grave and weep beneath a sleepless flesh of sky. And you thought these weight-filled branches would braid themselves against the roof and root this house to earth? But how often have we tugged at curves in the dark to remake our scars and slay our death? Here the truck sounds are unhealed, like all our comings and goings. But what of making a home, you ask, while across the street the bulldozer flattens the torso of the last almond tree?
Mm.
Tomorrow they will flatten Fallujah, the newswoman says swiftly, no sign of carnage in her eyes. And through the stomach of the house, my child is asking, how many moons did we leave behind? And that's Curves in the Dark.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yes.
Thank you, Pamela.
And I do want to tell our listeners that this has been our late night poetry jam with Dima Shahabi, and it's been a total delight and pleasure to have her on the air. And I'm definitely going to get 13 Departures from the Moon, and as well as All Matanabe Street Starts Here, and I suggest everybody else does that too.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much and for being with us today.
It was an absolute pleasure, Pamela. Thank you so much.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.